You're listening to We Are SDS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are SDS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 26. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. You know how sometimes you're in a situation you just don't like, where something's broken and it just makes you angry, but if only someone could just step up and sort it out? Well, our guests today found themselves in just this spot. In their case, they're the ones who stepped forward, and they're the ones who did the sorting. The result is monumental. I'm talking about a book published this year from UCL Press with the title Women in the History of Science, a source book. It's original materials from over 50 women, sampling topics across a huge range of time and place. Some of these sources are published for the first time. All are carefully curated with brief introductions from experts in the know. This source book is designed so everyone can add more voices from women and more diverse voices to familiar stories in the history of science, technology, and medicine. Best of all, this book is free, available for open access download from the publisher. This book has a special place here in STS. The book has five editors, all five recently completed PhD degrees in our department. They helped teach our courses. They added a lot to our community. Well, it took a bit of juggling, but we managed to get everyone together to talk about the book, the work that inspired them, and what they think is special about this new contribution to scholarship. As usual, to get us started, I asked everyone simply to introduce themselves. Maybe we start with Hannah.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Hannah Wills, and I'm R&D producer at Royal Holloway University of London, but also an honorary research associate in the SDS department at UCL.
Fantastic. Thanks. Sadie.
I'm Sadie Harrison. I'm also an honorary research fellow with SDS at UCL, and I also work in an environmental service.
Fantastic. Erica.
Hi, my name is Erica Jones, and I'm curator of navigation and oceanography at National Maritime Museum, Greenwich. I'm also a honorary research fellow at UCL STS department, which is fantastic.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Becky.
Hi, I'm Becky Martin. I work half the week as a research fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and the other half of the week at the National Maritime Museum. I am also an honorary fellow in the STS department at UCL. And
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And finally, Farah.
I'm Farah Lawrence Mackey. I am also an honorary research fellow at the STS department in UCL, and I am a trainee solicitor.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. And I have to say for the listeners that because I know all of you so well, I speak with you very informally, and that's not fair because you're all PhD doctors. You're all fantastic. You're all brilliant. And so please excuse my informality. It's no measure of disrespect. It's because we're all part of that STS community. Well, let's get started talking about the book that's coming out. In a nutshell, you know, what's this book about? What does it cover?
I'm happy to start that off. So it's Hannah here. So our book is really a collection of primary sources accompanied by brief explanatory essays and discussion questions, all devoted to exploring women's involvement in the production of knowledge in the history of science. So we've aimed to be quite broad in our scope. So we feature women all the way from antiquity right up to the present day, as well as women from around the world. We've tried to be sort of quite intentionally global in our scope. And I should mention as well that the book is the combined work of ourselves here, but also 53 other contributors from all around the world at all different career stages. So it's a really kind of collaborative project.
We'll talk about bringing all those people together into one package. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's come back to that question of what does this book cover? It's a source book, and it's a source book focused on women in the history of science. But can you tell me what that's going to be when I open it up?
So it's Farah here. So we really didn't intend for the book to be an alternate canon within the history of science, nor is it like a global, it's not as global or indeed as complete as we would have liked it to have been. We haven't touched on gender identity or sexuality quite as much as we would have liked to have done. But what we have tried to do is redress the current balance slightly in the sort of sources available in the history of science, which is predominantly white men, and ask some really big questions with those sources. So what is science? How do we define it? What do we consider it to, a primary source to be? How do we define the spaces that science is done in, where it takes place, and who has access, really importantly, to scientific knowledge? We see the book really as a starting point for really beginning to think differently and to expand the current canon within the history of science. We really want to encourage other people to challenge what we're finding and find out more untold stories themselves within sort of the broader history of science. So that's really what we're looking to do with this book, I suppose.
One of the motivations for the project, Farah, was sitting in a class on history of science or sitting in a couple of classes on history of science and just saying, you know, where are the women and where are the wider stories? Where's the additional perspective? And then to your five fantastic credit, you said, I'm going to do something about this. I'm not just going to complain about it. I'm just going to do something about it. And you went off and found sources and found stories. Does that accurately capture the idea here?
Yes. Yeah, I was. As you said, Joe, you're completely right. This really stemmed out of our own teaching experience. And I think more than, you know, sitting in a classroom ourselves, it was when, for me, I started to teach the history of science, and I didn't have an answer to my students when the students asked me, you know, why does this course not have more women? Why does this course only talk about white Western men? And, you know, I'm not teaching my own materials, and you kind of have to teach what you're given, but I couldn't give them a straight answer. And we all kind of resonated on that experience. It was something that had come up for all of us when we were delivering courses. And I think that was what we said we wanted to do. We want to do something about this. We want to fix this. But more than that, we want to fix it in a way that is actually sustainable within academia, right? So obviously I can't change things overnight. And if I want to design a completely new module with all of the huge range of things that we have in the source book in it, then I need to become an expert in 50, 60 different topics overnight. And that's just not feasible for me, but also, you know, within academics' workload allocations, when we're talking about how people get, you know, time to do projects when they're a lecturer, when they're a professor. And one of the things we really wanted to do is make it so that it was accessible for academics to just kind of port over this stuff into their course. It's got questions for seminars to be asked, so you don't have to think about those. It's got further reading so that you can set essays on this and to direct your students to other things to read about every single one of the sources in this book. And that was really important for us, is making it something that would be usable for other academics.
Oh, fantastic. And that you snuck something in there, which I didn't expect, which was, Joe, it's going to save you time. I really like that idea. To say that you do hear this a lot, and you guys are brilliant at picking this up, which is to simply say, I don't have the time to track all these subjects and all this stuff. And it looks here like it's on a plate, that you have provided a resource on a plate. And so that I don't have time argument is no longer valid. Becky, did I pick that up fairly?
Yeah, exactly. You know, everybody has time for this. And I know we're going to say later as well, but it's open access. So not only does everybody have time, but everybody will be able to access it for free whenever they want.
Yeah, it just like removes all excuses, you know. Thank you very much. Like I don't have time. Well, tough. And I don't and I don't have any money. Well, tough. You know, it's like no excuse anymore, Joe. Fix your bloody curriculum.
This is Sadie. We were looking out at our students, and I think only a very small percentage of the demographics of the students were the same demographic that were being taught about, and also the same demographic of the academics whose work was being taught. So if we wanted to represent to anybody who was not white cis male, not just white cis male, but also sort of that very default kind of person in academia and the default kind of person in society, that we were getting in a lot of students who were queer identifying. We were getting in a lot of students who were women and who were non-binary and who were people of color or immigrants. And these different backgrounds were coming to us, and they were not seeing themselves represented as being able to succeed in STS. So it was important for us not only to provide information that would map onto a survey course for the history of science, but also to provide models of people who were succeeding and being published in the history of science. In the event that these students wanted to continue on with their studies, no one's going to be attracted to a field where they think they won't be heard. And right. So it was very important for us to seek out early career researchers who were doing emerging work and who were not just white men, who were women, who were from around the world. We really wanted to try and reach as many different narratives as possible and to represent as many different narratives as possible, not just in the sources that are being talked about, but also in the voices that are doing the talking.
Right. Yeah, that's brilliant. You've really picked on a really important theme that is of the last decade or so, which is that basic claim of, I want to see my voice represented in the stories told inside this classroom. I want to see something that I can identify with. You have really picked up on that idea. And I suppose being the cis white male old person. And what I really, really love about this project is it's not just people standing up saying, I want to say something, but I look at it and think, man, I need to read these. I need to hear these voices. And my own vision of history is vastly narrowed without them. And so that I think you've done a service not just for the people who say I want to be represented, but you've done a service for people who haven't heard the voices and who need to hear the voices and frankly who will benefit from hearing the voices. So that's fine. Do you think I've got that idea right?
Yes, absolutely. And part of the reason we have made every single effort to combat excuses for not reading this is because it's not only that it needs to be as easy as possible to include, but it also needs to be as hard as possible to ignore.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yes. You really know, you folks really know me very well. You really caught me. Every excuse isn't going to work anymore.
I just wanted to say as well for sort of why we did it is that it wasn't that we weren't seeing exciting research into different narratives happening, because that's what our experience at STS was. Doing a PhD in STS, everyone around you is doing something exciting and different and interesting. But for me personally, I felt like, this is Farah, by the way, I felt like we were seeing every day in our colleagues in the department all this exciting research. And then we're going into the classroom and what we're teaching is the same course that it's felt like it was the same courses that have been being taught for the last 50 years, like that we're seeing just this same old white male narratives being told to the students while we're all doing, and we know everyone in STS is doing this really exciting cutting edge research. And the same is true in all of the STS departments and history of science departments around the world. And we wanted to sort of reflect that in what students are learning, because I think they're more going to be much more interested in that newer research than in sort of tired old narratives, really.
That's brilliant.
Oh, can I jump in there as well? I think that was really important for us, because this, when we're talking about survey courses, everybody thinks survey courses are really dull, right? It's History of Science 101, and it's going to be Plato into, you know, the Renaissance, into germ theory, and that's what you're going to get. But I don't think that it has to be that way, and I really don't think it's a great way to sell what we do to students, especially if, you know, that's the only module they take in STS. We have loads of students from across UCL take our courses, and it's the same kind of setup in universities in the US and other universities in the UK and across the world, the way you take one course. And do we want History of Science 101 as it was to be what we show people? What that is that our showcase course? And I don't think that we should be leaving it as it is. And that was one of the things that we wanted to do with this, is make it more exciting to bring more people to the discipline.
We've talked about the audience a little bit and who this book is for. Who was in your mind as the audience while you were putting this project together?
This is Sadie again. We talked a lot to the people who were actually responsible for delivering History of Science survey courses, both here and in mainly the States. You know, just at conferences, we'd be like, all right, is this your experience too? And the problem that everyone would come up against is overhaul. It would have required overhaul. I think we've touched on that a little bit before, that in order for every single university to teach an up-to-date History of Science course, that would require every single university to go through all of the processes to overhaul the complete curriculum. And that's not necessarily feasible. So what we wanted to do was to make a book that would not overhaul the curriculum, but would map directly onto it as a supplementary source. So you can sort of overlay or slot into this piece of the puzzle that hasn't previously been part of the syllabus. You can assign it as a supplementary book, or assign one or two readings from it every week as an option, or you can have it out and in the actual seminars. Mm-hmm. You can engage with it as much or as little as you have room for in your classroom. We really made it, you know, we thought about going for sort of less conventional organizational chapters. We ended up going for generally the structure of the course of a survey from ancient times to the present, because we thought that would be the structure that was shaped the way that the surveys are shaped.
Yeah, and so you use chronology as a way to organize.
Yeah, exactly. We thought more about, you know, what if we did themes? What if we did geography? But the way that survey courses usually happen is from year such and such BC to year right now. And it's not the most exciting or revolutionary way to do it, but it is the most useful way to do it, because we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We just wanted to put some much needed improvements on the wheel.
No matter what the theoretical interpretation is of any of this material, the primary sources speak. And that, again, I think is the real beauty of a source book, is that yes, of course, there's interpretation here, but this is as close to the bone as you can get with History of Science sources. And again, I think the way you guys have you've withheld that interpreting layering of material, I think, is a super advantage.
Yes, you are exactly right. We were not only teaching what is the history of science, what is the role of women in the history of science, but also how do you work with a source? We're aware that often History of Science 101 classes are taught at the beginning of someone's further education. And sometimes we did come up with, are we being too simple about this? But also we are aware that we are teaching a skill set as well as teaching a particular story. We're teaching how to do history. And we discuss this a lot in our chapters, in our essays, and our contributors discuss this a lot, is what is and isn't a source is a way for historians to grant access or bar access. And we wanted to grant as much access as possible.
Yeah, okay. I maybe we'll come back to what you excluded, but we'll come back to that later, perhaps. Farah, you wanted to come in. What would you like to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, just thinking about partly about access, I suppose, but also about the audiences and how broad in some ways we want our audiences to be. We have also included, there's quite a lot of sources in their original language, followed by translations, which I think was really important for us, because we were talking about reading, as you were saying, reading these sources as they were written. There's that important question and problem of translation. So as much as possible, we wanted to include original sources in the language they were written in and really question how translation works, how it bars access, and how it relates to power in academia. So mm-hmm. We thought that was quite a significant kind of an important thing for us in this project.
And you could see in a classroom where somebody's going to be teaching about some of this material that's presented in translation, and you can see a hand go up, and you can see a student say, no, I checked with my mom who speaks that, and she said, no, that's not what it says. And then you're into that conversation, like you said, about how who's doing the translating, what is the power relationship, how is authenticity engaged here, and all that kind of material. And that you could just see that conversation light up a classroom. So well done for not just translating, but also including it, seeing the issue from lots of different points of view. I think that's probably the way to say it. Yeah, brilliant. Well, let's talk about the different roles everybody took in this project. And I'm going to go around my sort of virtual circle here. Have you decided who wants to start first?
Hi, Joe. Yeah, it's Erica. So I'm going to start this off. This is why I love talking to you on this podcast, right? Because we can kind of open up the hood and look behind the scenes of how we made the source book happen. And I think it was really special that we worked together as an editing collective. And I don't think too many books are put together like this. I mean, considering we came together in late 2018, maybe early 2019, with this idea for this book. We were all PhD students in the STS department. We had this idea, we came together, and from the very beginning, we decided we want it to be sort of a collective effort. So I think a lot of people thought we were a bit crazy not to have the traditional hierarchy that is sort of considered when writing a book, but it worked out really well. And I feel like it made it so much more of a stronger project. And just to give you a quick example of how this worked was that I feel like in 2019, I was very active, taking an active role in organizing meetings and getting things together and set up. But then in my personal life, I had to go through major surgery, take some time off. And then that's when the baton went to Farah, and she really took up editing and organizing, and it on and on it went. And Farah had a baby while doing this project. And then, as you can imagine, that takes a lot of care and attention. And she was able to pass on the work to someone else. And I feel like not only did we help inspire each other and keep each other going, but it was a more sustainable model of working where we were literally sharing the load, because these life events happen. And so many times we're not given the space to do our work well and our lives. So that's just a little bit of the insight into this book. And I'm going to let someone else talk more about it. But for me, that was a really special thing about this book.
Great. Yeah. Thanks very much, Erica. Who wants to come in next?
Farah here. So I think sort of going off of what Erica said, it was this really great kind of collaborative project. And as she said, there was no real kind of hierarchy involved. I think one of the things that I really enjoyed when we would work on things like our introductions and work on chapters together, we had like the sisterhood of the traveling chapter. It would pass between us and go through all these different changes. And it was just a really nice kind of process of supporting each other throughout, really. And as Erica said, obviously I had a baby during this and everyone was so supportive, and it didn't feel like I was letting anyone down by not being as present. And obviously we also had COVID in the middle of the project, which obviously occasionally threw one or two of us, or at one point I think three of us had COVID at the same time, so nothing was really going on. So it's been an experience, definitely. The other thing I think that's really important is while there's the five of us, there's also 53 other academics across the globe, and we have been working with them really closely, editing their work, talking with them about their sources, and that as well is this broad, collaborative, supportive kind of network. And I think, I hope I'm speaking for those 53 others when I say I think everybody's just really excited that this is finally going to see the light of day.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Farah. Who wants to come in next? Maybe Hannah?
Just kind of picking up on what Farah said there, I think one of the really exciting things working with these 53 other academics was getting to find out more about their research. And there were often kind of situations where we'd come across someone who's working on, you know, so many interesting projects, and we kind of suggest to them, like, what would you like to write about? What do you think would be really important to feature in this book? So I'm not sure, this is kind of the first edited collection I've done, and I'm not sure if it's kind of usual practice, but I feel like I learned a lot so much from the people we were working with and kind of finding out what they thought was important for students to learn about. So yeah, putting in things that they particularly wanted to tell us about, things that they felt needed to be heard. And I think that's a really great strength of the book. In fact, now that it's all together, we've got some, I guess, familiar faces, women that you might expect to read about. We've got kind of Ada Lovelace and people like that. But we've also got so many women that I'd kind of never heard about before, never come across before. So many different cultures and areas of knowledge production as well. And I think that's all because we worked with all these different scholars from around the world and sort of listened to what they were working on and what they felt was important to kind of raise in the history of science and make students aware of. So that's been a really exciting part of the process, I think, of writing.
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks very much. I can see in the years to come, I can see the Sourcebook Collective being the kind of gathering around at professional meetings where you and your gang of 53 people will be in the club and everyone else will be on the outside going, man, I wish I said yes to that. You know, I wish I was involved. Well, maybe volume 2 and 3 and 4 can just keep it going. You guys can hand it down to the next generation of people who want to keep the narrative changing going. So let's continue on. So Becky, what would you like to say?
Becky here. I think we had a really lovely way of working where we would, you know, we'd be able to just dive into something that somebody else on the team had written and not just, you know, critically edit, but also go, this is a really lovely point. I really like how you've worded this. And it was just a really supportive environment. It's my favorite writing experience to date, because there are so many people and we wanted to cover so much. The book is so broad. We also had kind of a bit of a process of needing to fill gaps in the book. So we would go, okay, well, we probably want some more sources from this era or on this subject. And just basically splitting it up between the five of us going, okay, so who knows somebody who works on this, or who has access to this listserv to post something on. And it was just kind of, and splitting things up to make sure that, you know, everybody's got people to be talking to and things to be editing, and then circle it round. So Hannah's chapters and her contributors all come over to me, and mine all go over to Farah, and Farah's all go over to Sadie, and Sadie's go to Erica, and round in a big circle until we're back and it's all been edited, basically.
Yeah. Well, again, Becky, I think what's just brilliant about about that is I can't tell you how many editorial meetings I've been in where the conversation goes along the lines that you say, but it takes a different turn, which is basically, okay, we've got 20 authors here. We know we're missing the Global South. We know we don't have enough female voices. We know we don't have non-white voices. We know we're missing. Well, just forget it. You know, it's just too hard to find people. Let's move on. But I think what you did was to say, well, that's just not good enough. We're just going to have to try. And we've got to look, and we've got to look harder. And if we can't find it, well, surely there's a way. And I think this is a real model for what a solid academic expectation should be of editorial work these days. So if you have a set of essays, it can't just be you and your mates coming together. That's just not good enough anymore. And it's not good enough because I think it's groups like you who come together and say, we can do better. So you're making it harder, but in the best way harder for the next generations, you know, the next generation of proposals for books. And I can't tell you how valuable that is to be in an editorial board and say, well, you know, if 5 PhD students can do it, you can do it. Sadie, tell us what you wanted to add here.
It's funny because it is a book about science and technology that I'm not sure would exist without the very, very recent emerging technologies of, well, I say recent because I write about the early modern era, but this couldn't really have happened the way it did 10, 15 years ago. Most of our editing did not happen in the same room. Most of our editing did not happen with paper. Most of our editing didn't see people face to face. I still don't know what most of my contributors' faces look like. And a lot of our people we reached came from social media. We couldn't have reached around the globe without global technology. It's very much it's a process from the present time. The collaborative process was extremely virtual, and it benefited greatly from virtual technologies that allowed us to be anywhere and be talking to anyone. We weren't limited by who we were next to.
Yeah, again, I think that's fantastic. Your creativity with using the technology is something that's entirely invisible. It's really easy to think edited collections happen because people know people and they use their social networks. But that's only a small part of the story, isn't it? You folks have gone out and expanded your networks phenomenally in order to draw in the people into the community.
Yes, we yelled into the void until somebody yelled back. We were worried about just going around British universities and hearing from British university people. And we do have a fair amount of British university people, but we also have people from, you know, the opposite end of the world that we would never have been able to meet in person.
Okay, let me jump in here. This is a good time to take a short break.
Hey there, my name is Mandy, and I'm a student of History and Philosophy of Science at SDS. What I love about SDS is how it allows us the time and teaches us the tools to think deeply and critically about the most pressing issues of our time through various lenses: historical, philosophical, sociological, and political.
Hello, I'm Heiss, an IBSC student studying policy, communications, and ethics. What I love about STS is the diversity. You get to meet people from various backgrounds and discuss the current issues and topics, which are fascinating and engaging.
Let's get back to our conversation about the book, Women in the History of Science, a Source Book. We're still talking about the book itself, but let's widen the frame of reference to talk more about the editors and their careers. So let's look beyond this particular project and let's see if we can frame the work you've done in terms of what's happened next and what you see happening in the future. Everybody's completed their PhDs. Everybody's gone on to additional phases in their life. So for each of you, you know, what are you doing now? Help us understand how this book has helped you move along. What are you doing now? Who wants to start with that?
Hi, yeah, so I'll start with that one. So Becky here. So I have stayed in academia as one of the kind of traditional route out of the PhD. I'm currently doing two research fellowships, which speak to each other in kind of convoluted ways, I guess. but essentially, the way that this has kind of taken forwards into my career, I guess, is that I've taken the practical aspect of, you know, there's a problem here, let's do something about it. And really, that's something that I am passionate about in my work. So my personal research looks at the history of race and colonialism in the context of the history of medicine and science. And it, for me, it's not enough to basically just go, okay, well, I'm going to do some research, but I need to be making sure that that research has impact. So making sure that I'm part of EDI committees and I'm discussing what's happening now to tackle structural racism that I see being established in the past in historical settings. And that's what I've taken forwards from this project, is that, you know, we can make changes, and that's something I try and do.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks very much. Who's next?
Hi, this is Erica. That's really inspiring, Becky, by the way. So when I was doing my PhD in the STS department, it was with a collaborative doctoral project with the National Maritime Museum. And so after I got my PhD, I was very lucky to get a position there as curator of navigation and oceanography. And I feel like I've really brought a lot of the things that I learned from those critical STS conversations into my role there. I'm embedded in the history of science team, so we're very conversant on these topics, but also, again, looking at sources and, of course, objects is what we talk a lot about at the museum, stories that revolve around objects. But again, informed by this Women in History of Science project, my work around the Challenger expedition, which went around the world looking at the deep ocean in the 1870s, I've tried to think of it in a different way, not focusing on the six white male European scientists who generally get a lot of the credit, but trying to look for the other people, the places, the stories involved. And I feel like I've taken that from this project and STS department more generally. So I'm trying to carry that on and agree with what you said, Becky. It's been an inspiring voyage.
Yeah, I can go next. It's Hannah here. So I'd say, having completed my PhD, I've kind of moved into, I guess, sort of academia adjacent work, I'd say. So I work now in research management, and I've done this in a couple of different contexts. So after the PhD, I went to work at the Imperial War Museum as their research manager. And then more recently, I'm an R&D producer at Royal Holloway. And so what I do now, I guess a bit different to the PhD, is I really kind of support academics getting funding applications in. I support kind of bringing together industry collaborations with academia. And then while I was at the museum, doing that in a kind of cultural heritage type sector. So I guess it's maybe kind of an unconventional career route, but actually I feel like it's something that I think is really, really interesting. And I think doing a PhD, you get a lot of the kind of skills which are so useful in kind of professional services within a university or a museum. So having that kind of firsthand experience of research, I think, is really helpful now, thinking about how to make kind of other people's research shine, how to kind of make people aware of the value of university research and what researchers are doing. So I think while it's maybe kind of an unconventional route possibly, and I'm not sort of focusing so much on my own research in my actual kind of day-to-day job, I think it's something that I'd like to, I guess, yeah, I wish more people were kind of more aware of, I guess, because definitely when I was kind of doing my PhD in the kind of, in the throes of the research, I wasn't sort of thinking so much about this kind of academia adjacent sort of career path, but it's definitely one that's really interesting. And yeah, I guess like Becky was saying, the kind of book has taught me a lot about problem solving, about kind of bringing together collectives, how to build a kind of fruitful network. And that's something that's super, super important, I think, in sort of roles within professional services when you're thinking about securing more funding for research and that sort of thing. So,
And now you have an object that you can throw down on the table with somebody who's giving you difficulties and say, look, just do it like this.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. A nice model.
Yeah, thanks, Anna. Thanks very much. Who wants to go next? Maybe Sadie?
So this is Sadie, and I finished my PhD in sort of women's participation in botany, and now I'm participating in delivering environmental projects and sustainability projects. So I guess there's a throughway. But I'm also keeping one little foot in academia. I've founded and organized conferences for a network on the sort of feminine or genderqueer experience in networks of knowledge or networks of sharing information and participatory cultures.
You sound so apologetic, like that's not academics, but come on, this is robust and strong.
I mean, it is very much the kind of thing that we were speaking to with not just the content of our project, but also the process of putting it together. The different narratives surrounding how information is made and shared and the practices of collaboration. That we found sustainable.
Yeah, and again, I could see this book landing on many tables around you, where you can say, "Look, if we could do this, you can do. You don't need 60,000 people flying in planes around to do things to come to meetings. You can solve problems in other ways too." I could see you doing that. That's fantastic. Farah, tell us what you got.
So I have. I'm not even academia adjacent anymore. I am retraining as a solicitor. I did take on an academic post for a year after the PhD. I was lucky enough to get a welcome funded role at the Science Museum. But, and I think some of the things we speak to a little bit in the book are some of the more deep rooted inherent problems with academia, one of which, especially for women, is that if you want to have a family, the sustainability of moving once a year to a different job and the lack of maternity cover on a lot of funded projects makes it very, very difficult to kind of pursue that. So I wanted a family, and I found that retraining as a solicitor, the law, you have a sustainable and continual salary and maternity pay. So that was part of the reason I left. And I think that really the project for me was kind of, it was nice to kind of still have an idea of what was happening in academia and to still be doing something academic. But, and it's assisted me in my studies for retraining, because obviously it's a lot of research, a lot of having to learn a great deal of new information. But it's really just, kind of the book, I think, speaks to some of those more inherent deep-rooted problems that kind of affect women and sort of your ability to progress in certain careers.
Yeah, I can also see you, Farah, loving primary sources as a historian, because the law is you know, when you finally get down to it, is what was the contract you signed? Don't tell me what it says. Show me what it says.
Yes, right? there's a lot of useful kind of skills from the PhD that I'm using in my day to day work. I deal with a lot of contract law and a lot of sort of title. Land law, which is really detailed and very complex, but it's definitely given me sort of a hand in that kind of detailed research, really, I suppose, seeing things that you wouldn't necessarily consider.
Yeah, and listeners won't know this, Farah, but I do, and I know how hard you worked on your PhD to just squeeze out every bit of information from pretty scant primary sources, and also just basically calling nonsense on a lot of stories that people who later were claiming credit for things that I think you concluded quite rightly that they didn't deserve. And again, that's, you know, I could just see you just, you know, on a Wednesday moving some documents around in the office and think, yep, this looks a lot like my research. It really does.
There's definitely a lot of that in there. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's have a shout out for Mothers Everywhere. You've got bedtime stories here for the rest of your life, really.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, that's true. And very, very kindly, I think, Erica, Becky, Hannah, and Sadie suggested that the book be dedicated to my daughter, which I thought was very sweet of them. So it is dedicated to Rowan, which is lovely.
Fantastic. Well, fantastic. See, history books have a history. I think that's the way to say it. And I'm going to try reading some of this out to my own stepdaughter and see and see how it goes. We'll see what happens. Anyway, thank you all. And I love the idea that that relationship to the academy is such a fluid and evolving one. And by God, there's so many things to do besides be in the academy. That's the lesson that I certainly would listen to coming out of here. Okay, so let's move on and let me ask a couple more questions. And then I'm going to sneak another one in on you. And I'm just going to ask you, what's your favorite of all the essays here, of all the material? So you can have a little bit of time to think about that. But the but looking back on this project, looking back on it now, what would you say the project did for you as a person in your moment? What did it contribute to you?
I can start off on this one. It's Hannah here. I'd say moving out of academia, this project has just been an amazing writing outlet and an amazing opportunity to stay in touch with the history of science community that I think had I not been involved with it sort of with this book, I wouldn't have been as in touch as I have been. So meeting really interesting scholars from all around the world, but also staying really up to date with the historiography and kind of the latest trends in the history of science. I think this project has been amazing for just kind of, I guess, keeping one foot still in the history of science while pursuing other things in my career. So yeah, that's what I've particularly enjoyed.
Farah here. I would say really similar. It's been a really nice kind of thing to have going on that it doesn't feel like I just kind of left academia and was completely cut off. I've sort of left and it's felt like a slow kind of release of the academic kind of side of my career. And I think for me personally, it's just been really, really nice to have a reason to stay in touch with Becky, Erica, Hannah, and Sadie. it's just been, yeah, really nice to have this project ongoing with them.
Sorry, Erica here. And just very quickly to add to that, I would say I had this great sense of achievement working with this amazing group of women, and we just kept at it. Considering the very beginning, there were people who thought we wouldn't be able to do it. And there was a lot of doubters. There was support, but with a grain of salt, telling us it's going to be really hard. Are you sure you can do this? And we stuck with it. And it's so exciting that it's finished. I can't hardly believe it.
I think it's also given the gift of sanity and consistency for 5 years of early career uncertainty as well as international uncertainty. But during the pandemic, I technically had work. It was a thing that I was doing that was productive and a thing that I was doing that was social, that was also very easy to explain to people, for example, at Christmas. Academic or in anything academic adjacent, it's extremely difficult to give an elevator pitch that someone who is vaguely related to your partner will understand over a bit of punch. But if you say, I'm writing a textbook, that's a great way to be like, I am contributing. I am productive. I am contributing. And even though, you know, we've had a very, it's just been a ridiculous 5 years since we started talking about this. It's been a through line that was sometimes a lifeline.
Right.
And now we have this thing and everything is so different from how it was when we started. I mean, literally a baby gestated and came into the world in a much shorter amount of time than this book. And it's sort of, it's very strange to think that this book is now coming into the world after having, you know, been just something we were cooking for so long.
You're making me wonder, what the hell did I do during the pandemic?
So, I know, right?
It's great to feel envious this way. Becky, is there anything you wanted to throw in on this?
Yeah, it's Becky here. So looking back on the project now, I can't express like how proud I am of the whole group. And I think this is something that through the really tough years of applying for jobs in academia, and you get a lot of knockbacks, this was something that not only did I, you know, have work to do, as Sadie said, but that I was really passionate about and I was really certain of. This is something that I really wanted to get out into the world, kind of regardless of where I ended up. Because it's something that I think is really important, and I hope it inspires others to do more, and I hope it inspires somebody to do volume two in 5 years' time. And I think the main thing that we've discussed as well, you know, we talked about the fact that a lot of us have left academia and that it's difficult, and we really hope that this book is something which can kind of make a little bit of that easier for ECRs, early career researchers who are going in, having to teach something that they know nothing about for 10 weeks, and they can bring this to their classrooms, and it just takes one thing off of their plate whilst they're also applying for 50 jobs and, you know, trying to write a book from their PhD and thinking about articles and not being paid enough. So that, for me, I think it's kept me going, the idea that it's doing something important that people will need and use.
That's brilliant. I mean, we were talking about how easy this makes engaging some of the sources, but also that notion of virtue, that you're making other people's lives easier on purpose in order to effect the change that we all want to see in the world. It's just, again, a really noble part of this particular. What advice would you give to somebody starting something like this, or somebody embarking on a source book like this? What advice would you give them?
Farah here. I think the main piece of advice is be prepared for the long haul. I think there's a false impression that doing an edited collection is sort of an easy way to get a publication. It's simpler. It's, you know, you're not doing the majority of the work. Somebody else is doing the writing and you're just editing it. That is not true. Having done it, it is very, I mean, we did set ourselves a bit of a ludicrous task with so many contributors, but knowing that if you want to produce something like this, it's going to take a lot of time, and a lot more time than you think it will. And just make sure that because of that, the team you're working with is a strong one, I think, and a good, positive, collaborative team, which I think I can say we were really lucky that we had that.
Fantastic. Good team and long haul. I think that's a really great combination of priorities. Okay, right. You guys have come to the key question here, which is favorites. Really what I want to know is there something in here that you're especially joyful to be presenting? Does anybody want to fess up and say they have a favorite?
Yeah, I can jump in to start with this one. So, you know, obviously, apart from my own source, which is fabulous, one of the sources I love is something that I edited by Anne Van Veen on homunculus monkeys. So it's on a female monkey used in polio testing. And for me, when we received that source submission and we were discussing, you know, what the book's going to look like, what's going to go in, the fact that we've not just included, you know, women from around the world, women from different classes and different places and different perspectives on science, but we're also thinking about, you know, non-human women. and moving the ball even further than we thought we would be able to with this book, just by virtue of the fantastic contributors that we have had submissions from.
One of our contributors wrote about the Oxford hangings, which are a set of embroidery done by Bess of Hardwick and Mary Queen of Scots. And I had used that in my PhD thesis because these are embroidery that represent animals, both real and imagined. And it was just, it was very, oh, I know this thing. And this somebody else thinks it's relevant. That's brilliant.
It is really difficult to choose. I think that probably one of my favourites is the photograph of rural Portuguese women sorting silkworms from our contributor, Isabel Zilhau. I think it's a really great source because it's one, it's obviously using a different format of force. So it's a photograph, it's not a written text, more traditional kind of what you would expect from a scientific source. I think the other thing that I really love about this is that it does demonstrate how you can see sort of these unnamed women. So they're not, they're just doing the practical day-to-day work of science. If you were to take an extract from a academic paper on science to sort of as your source for scientific advancement or scientific work, you would miss these people, the people in the background doing the actual work of science. And I think that's what a lot of our sources kind of highlight. It's not the big names, it's the day-to-day people doing the work of science.
Well, again, it's a tough choice, but I think there's one that stands out for me, and that's the unnamed working class woman's handwritten family recipe. It's from the 1980s, and that was submitted by Catherine Price. And the reason why it sticks with me, because it was a source that actually challenged my own ideas of scientific knowledge and what is science and who can we consider a producer of knowledge. And honestly, before that time, I hadn't thought about recipes and women working in the kitchen as a place of science. And so I really had to think about it. And it was great to talk with a group about it and to read this source. And when I would mention it to other people talking about the source book, I could say things like, oh, and we have a recipe. And people would, again, would have that conversation again. Is that science? Is that producing knowledge? And by the end of this project, I felt by seeing all these sources that I was able to actually expand my own way of thinking about the production of knowledge. And so that was great for me, that source, because it did spark other conversations about science, which that's what I really hope this book does. And it does through so many different varied sources that there will be some that people will perhaps find challenging, or they'll see a familiar source in a new way. And we've written some provocative questions, and our contributors have questions about the source to help spark some of these conversations. So that's what I like, the dialogues and the conversations that happen around these sources. I think that's one of the real beauties of this book.
Yeah, so I think one of the most exciting thing for me about this book is that we've got a few surprises in there. So it's not kind of all just textual sources. We've got a really, really wide range of materials. So as Sadie's already said, we've got textiles in there. And in fact, one of my favorite sources, I have to say, is a set of geological hammers used by Gertrude Lillian Ells. And that piece was written for us by Sandra Freshney. And I just love the fact that we've got this geological hammer in the book. It kind of, I guess, as Erica was saying, it helps you kind of question, what is a source? How do we use this? And what is there to say about a hammer? And I think that's really fun that it's not kind of just all traditional textual things. I think also something that's really exciting for me is where we do have texts, we've kind of taken them from perhaps sort of surprising places. So it's not all sort of, you know, publications from the Philosophical Transactions or, you know, kind of published scientific articles that we're looking at. There's another really brilliant source by Shang Fu Huang, and he's taken three illustrations from a Chinese ladies magazine, the Ladies Journal. And that's just brilliant, looking at how the representation of women interacts with knowledge production and what we can get from these illustrations and what it tells us about science and culture in China. So although it's a kind of, it's from a sort of more textual type source, I think it's just really exciting using these sources in new ways. And that's really kind of tied to one of the main questions that we ask in the source book. What is a source, but also what is science? What is knowledge production? And can we sort of broaden it out from just sort of considering standard scientific publications? What happens if we look at a recipe book? What happens if we look at a magazine and kind of reframe what we think about knowledge production and who gets to produce knowledge, if you see what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And that, in fact, brings us all the way around to the beginning of our conversation, I think, where we were talking about the decision of what is a source. It brings with it a lot of power, being able to say it's this and not that. And so if the only thing we're going to do is look at articles in Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, we have made lots of decisions over who to include or not. And what I hear you saying is that, boy, if we widen our notion of where women are speaking and where there's evidence of women's activities in science, we embrace lots of other things besides those printed sources. And as soon as you start widening things out, the response is going to be, wow, right? Wow, there's a lot more here. So we have come all the way around. And let me ask you before we're done, is there anything that any of you wanted to say or wanted to ask each other before we finish out? Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
Hi, this is Erica. I think we all probably want to add some things. But for me, I think one of the exciting things about this book, and it's really important, that it's being published by UCL Press, and everything that they publish is open access. That means that anyone around the world can download this book as a PDF. They can use it in the classroom and academics setting, but they can also just read it for fun. If they want to engage in these conversations, it becomes a much wider conversation and inclusive. And that's the whole point of this book, is to really broaden out these conversations around the history of science, around history more generally, and also women's role in science. So I think it's just so important to bring out the fact that very often the cost of purchasing books is a real barrier to the free flow of education and information. And so we're just really thankful that UCL Press is doing this as open access. So thanks to them and Chris Penfold for putting this project forward.
Brilliant. I'm sure they'll be quite appreciative of that. And for everybody. And for everybody listening, I will put in the program notes. I'll put links to the book and so on. I think without being an ad for UCL Press, I think what's great about them is you get the book for free if you want. And also if you want your library to have a paper copy, you can buy that follow on or not. And the beauty about open access, you can have it both ways, really.
Right. But just normally to have to purchase a book would be, you know, 50, 60, 70 pounds or more. And that would just create a barrier that we didn't want to have with this book.
So I'll jump in here because I think it links in really nicely with the previous point. So this is Becky. I just wanted to say that if you are downloading it open access, please don't miss the cover art, because it's not something that you will necessarily get when you download the chapter that you're downloading, but the cover art that we have was drawn for us especially by Farah's husband Tom, and it is a conglomeration of so many of the sources in the book. So everything that you see in the cover art is something that is discussed or pictured or, you know, included in some way within this source book. That is what makes up that beautiful picture. And it's just so fantastic. And I think I'm buying copies, you know?
well done, Tom. I'm looking at it right now and it is drawing my eye right into all the detail. Well, yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, it's Hannah here. I'd just like to jump in with another thank you. We'd really like to thank the team at Just Content who worked with us through the proofing stage of the book. So particularly Linda and Enya, who've been amazing to work with. I think for all of us being kind of newbies to the world of publishing, it was great having such a supportive team to go back to with all, you know, questions and how do you write an index and all of those, yeah, kind of new questions, I guess, for new authors such as ourselves. So yeah, that team's been brilliant to work with.
It falls to me to thank the STS department. I have a distinct memory of talking to a group of senior academics in the department about how can we affect the curriculum, and instantly the idea was, well, why don't you write a source book, talk to UCL Press, this is a great idea, go for it, it can happen, instead of, you know, well, this could possibly be a thing you could pursue. It was, no, do this, it'll work, which was really just brilliant. I don't think that any of us had really envisioned it as, you know, something where we would be standing here with a finished volume, but it was instantly a project that STS was behind and believed in, and that was that was really incredible.
Well, I have to say that the senior academics, all the academics in STS are just so proud to see this. When I reminded everyone that it was coming out, the smiles on everyone's faces, it's not only are they proud of you, but they respect you for having done such a fantastic and difficult job. And with respect comes a bit of envy, which is always a good thing in academics, because envy leads to people using it. And I think the real test of a source book like this is maybe 5 years down the road, will we see it in classrooms? Will we see students embracing it, loving it, hating it, fighting with it, arguing with it, adding to it, wanting to do another one? And I think that envy and respect is tested by use. And I know for sure, because I do have that crystal ball and I have looked ahead, and that I think, wow, this is going to be great. The community is really going to thank you for this down the road. So on behalf of all of us in the future, thank you very much, all five of you, for the hard work you've done. We're really, really proud of you. Well, I've said fantastic about 6,000 times in this interview, so I think it's about time to bring this to a close and let the book speak for itself. So before we do that, I want to thank all of you for coming today. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Jeff.
This is the biggest and the best episode of We Are STS that there's ever been. And until next time, we'll see everybody again. Bye now. I am literally jumping for joy right now. This is a fabulous piece of work. Lots of brand new material, a real collaborative treasure, and it shows fresh new thinking within our community. If you know someone interested in the ideas discussed today, or someone who wants to study in the general area, just ask them to get in touch. Maybe it's to explore stories like these in history. Or maybe they're interested in today's science, technology, and medicine. It all fits under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. We're a thriving community here at UCL, and there's always room for more. Music today included two pieces, Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod, and Silly Intro by Alexander Nakarada. Both are available online at filmmusic.io. And in the break, you also heard two current STS students, Mandy and Heiss. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. To find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or just give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we WRSTS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.
And also, I just want to say, Joe, thanks so much for your support over the years for this project. And you and Simon Werritt really were there for us when we needed it. So, yeah, really appreciate it from the beginning back in, was it 2018? So, yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for that. And I hope the recording is still going then.
Yes, feel free to add that. You can add that.